From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. There's more confusion today about where President Trump stands on gun control after he invited leaders of the National Rifle Association to the White House for an unannounced meeting last night. He appeared to side with the NRA on gun rights one day after appearing to side with Democrats on gun restrictions in a remarkable televised listening session.
So it's been a chaotic week in the White House with the shift on guns, as Peter just said. Plus, there's the resignation of Hope Hicks, the communications director, and reports that National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster could leave by the end of the month. And White House economic advisor Gary Cohen is also reportedly thinking about an exit. So let's bring in our Friday roundtable. Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC. Hey there, Beth.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And Domenico Montanaro, lead politics editor at NPR. Hi, Domenico.
Thanks for having me back again.
So, Beth, let me just start with you. There's chaos and then there's chaos. Where does this week fall in that spectrum?
You know, what you said is exactly right. There is chaos and then there is real chaos. And this week felt like real chaos. It really felt like the wheels have completely come off the bus of this White House for all sorts of reasons. But the staff defections that you mentioned have left the president fairly unmoored. He has gone out to basically violate the no-compromise rule with the NRA that Republicans typically follow, only then to seemingly rein it back in. He berated his attorney general on Twitter. He has announced a trade war on steel and aluminum tariffs without briefing lawmakers or doing any sort of pre-prep to make the various stakeholders aware that he was doing this. It's a totally unmoored Trump, much more so than we've seen. And because of the loss of Hope Hicks, as you said, who has been a guiding force in this White House, it's unclear whether this is really the new normal, that even though it was chaotic before, it seems much more chaotic now.
Domenico, let me ask you, though, inside the Beltway, definitely lots of people are talking about chaos. But outside of the Beltway, one wonders, I mean, the president's supporters may just see this as the president taking action and being decisive, even if his decisions are constantly changing.
That's totally possible. But I would point to an interview we had on air on NPR the other day with Congressman Massey from Kentucky. And I was struck by just how much he was willing to criticize President Trump. He noted that Trump won his state by 40 points, but still was willing to take him on. And when we asked him, well, do you feel like he's hurt his relationship with people on Capitol Hill? He said, I don't think the relationship has been very good at all from the beginning. So it's kind of hard to hurt it. So, you know, he's been taking that kind of stance. And to go to Beth's point here, you know, Hope Hicks is somebody who would not have been the first person we would have thought of who would have left this White House. She's sort of the last of the loyalists. But in Trump, President Trump apparently telling her the day before that how could she be so stupid as to tell investigators that she told white lies for the president, that seemed to be the last straw for her. And this, she is something like the 50th person who's now left the White House.
Is that an exaggeration, Domenico? Is that an actual number?
Oh, that's an actual number. Wow. I went and added them up, and there have been something like 14 or 15 very high-profile people and then staffers from various parts of the White House who've all left more than 50. Some of them have actually been reassigned to other places, so not counting them, it's a little over 50.
So, Beth, having said all that, I'm going to give you the unenviable task of trying to figure out where we stand on guns right now on Friday afternoon. Today, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told reporters that Trump conceptually still supports raising the age to purchase a gun to 21, and Trump did not necessarily support the universal background checks he seemed to back just 2 days ago. So, again, Beth, where are we? Do we know anything more about the future of these gun laws?
Well, we do know that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, has said he is not bringing any gun legislation up next week, which is a surprise, but basically because it reflects the fact that nobody really knows where the president stands. And because of the shock this week that many gun supporters had by seeing the president of the United States, a Republican, on television, on national television, musing that he would be okay with confiscating people's guns and then going to due process later, that floored everyone and hence led to that emergency meeting with the president and these NRA officials to clear things up. But it, as you said, it really didn't clear anything up, because even though Trump and NRA representatives both last night tweeted to say that they were back on the same page and that the president fully supports Second Amendment rights, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, as you mentioned this morning, said he's still musing about raising the age of eligibility to purchase a semi-automatic gun to 21, which is something the NRA just staunchly opposes. So we end basically where we started on all this, really not being fully clear on what the president supports, but still having that televised televised meeting with lawmakers for the ages. Huh. That video will exist forever, yeah, of the president saying that he is basically supportive of many gun control measures favored by Democrats.
And Domenico, it wasn't just on guns that he shocked members of his own party. It was also on this issue of trade and these proposed tariffs that he's putting out there. That shocked members of the Republican Party.
Absolutely. It's like he just doesn't know the issue. He seemed confused as to who the players were in the room when he was talking about guns and what the history of gun policy has been, what the alignments have been. I mean, to accuse Pat Toomey, the Republican senator from Pennsylvania, of being afraid of the NRA, which is why he didn't include raising the age from 18 to 21 for being able to purchase an assault-style rifle. There's so much wrong with that. It's very difficult to even begin to tell you, because, you know, the NRA hated Pat Toomey's immigration bill, and it was his gun bill, and it wasn't a comprehensive gun bill. It was a background check bill. So that was a big problem. When it comes to, you know, what he did with trade, this is the problem with playing checkers in a town that you have to play chess, because he's saying, I want to negotiate. I want to say to the steel companies, let's make you great again. But at what cost? You know, when you look at manufacturers, when you look at the American Petroleum Institute, people, groups that are traditionally Republican-leaning groups, are upset because their materials are going to spike. They're going to be the ones paying the price down the line on this, and that's irritating
them. And not only that, more American jobs rely on imported steel than rely on making steel, Beth. I mean, did he understand that, or was he just playing to that protectionist base that he went after during the election?
Well, to be fair to Trump, even though he's been very inconsistent on almost every position out there, he's been pretty consistent on trade and this notion that Americans are being hurt by unfair trade practices. Many people would disagree. In fact, the interesting thing, the sort of oversetting of this whole conversation is that we have a Republican president who is doing a protectionist trade war and has mused about confiscating people's guns. Those are things that Republicans would never in a million years dream, yeah, that one of their own would support. And so we're in completely uncharted territory here. But on trade, Trump is basically consistent with his message. He's always said he wanted to crack down on what he considered to be unfair sale of cheap aluminum and steel in this country. And he's doing exactly what he said. But as Domenico pointed out, he did so without really testing and evaluating the impact it would have on the broader economy and on other businesses and companies that typically are very Republican-leaning who are aghast by this.
Right.
And
so Trump is not only a stress test for democracy, but he's a stress test for the Republican Party. And, you know, this is essentially what new Republican nativist populism looks like, and he's putting that to the test.
I mean, it's Trumpism, right? I mean, that's the big question. Can it be called Republicanism anymore?
You put all of that – well, because we have such a binary system in this country, he has taken over. He conducted and successfully won a hostile takeover of the Republican Party.
Yeah. So let me ask you both this. We're sort of circling back to the chaos question here, because on the issue of tariffs, that's one of the things that reportedly may is leading to talk about White House economic advisor Gary Cohn thinking about resigning. And then there's the issue of H.R. McMaster also reportedly perhaps looking for the exit sign here. I mean, what impact, Beth, would that have on the administration's ability to function?
Well, Gary Cohn has thought about leaving in the past, most notably after the Charlottesville crisis when President Trump seemed to suggest that the neo-Nazi marchers and the folks opposing them were equivalent, or that there were good people on both sides. He then came roaring back into prominence during the whole tax cut debate and legislation and scored a big win there. People thought he was going to leave anyway after winning the new tax law and come back to New York. So the fact that he stuck around is a little bit of a surprise anyway. So this could perhaps offer him the chance to leave. But as we were discussing earlier, this White House has just been hemorrhaging people. There's almost nobody there anymore who's really, you know, keeping the lights on. If Gary Cohn leaves, if H.R. McMaster leaves, he'd be replaced eventually. But you know, if he walks out the door, you know, how many senior people who've been around this president for a while do you still have there? It's really the family. It's Jared and Ivanka, and they aren't in particularly stable shape either. So it's a dwindling universe surrounding this president right there in that White House.
And there are questions about their future in the White House as well. That is Beth Fooey. She is senior politics editor at NBC. And we've also been speaking with Domenico Montanaro, lead politics editor at NPR. Thanks to you both at this very interesting time.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Ahead of a big weekend for movies, the Oscars are on Sunday, and tomorrow films a little more outside the mainstream will be honored at the Independent Spirit Awards. A Japanese language film set in both Tokyo and California is among the nominees. Oh, Lucy is about a lonely, middle-aged woman from Tokyo whose life seems to get a little brighter when she starts taking English lessons from a young American teacher named John, who's played by Josh Hartnett.
We're just going to have fun, all right? It's a fun class. Please sit down. Sit down. Sit. It's important to relax because I teach American English. And in American English, when you speak it, you have to be lazy, all right? Lazy and relaxed.
John tells his student to wear a yellow wig and to adopt a new name, Lucy. But Lucy's new identity does not cover up the problems in her life, which gets even more complicated when she follows her much younger teacher back to America and falls in love. Oh, Lucy begins opening in theaters today, and joining me now is the writer-director Atsuko Hirayanagi. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me more about Lucy, because when we first meet her, she's very quiet. She has this terrible, dreadful desk job. She's burdened by her boss. She's lonely. She's just witnessed a suicide, and she's barely moved by it. She's a mystery.
Right. But that's her mask as well. It's a social mask she has to wear at her office not to stand out, to just serve the workforce and be part of you kind of have to be a wallflower. That's the job of an office lady in Japan. I don't know if you're familiar with office lady, but it's basically secretarial job you have to do, and you never move up in a career. Mm-hmm. And the best case scenario is to get married and have kids and then leave the office lady work. And then there's a new batch of new young office ladies come and they do the same task. So for Setsuko to be there for until 43 years old and being single, she's in different kind of bracket.
Yeah. Right, and Setsuko is her Japanese name. She goes by Lucy in other parts of the film when she's taking on her new identity. But you're right, she has no family. She has no children. She doesn't have a husband. She is very lonely. And, you know, it's interesting. When I see films that take place in Japan, as this one does, these sorts of themes, they often emerge, but they don't often emerge from the perspective of a woman.
Yeah, but I think it's anywhere, right? Maybe it's easier to find in the States, but it's hard to find a good women's story, I think, in general.
Yeah. So Lucy's life starts to change a little bit when her niece Mika convinces her to take these English classes. And I want to hear a little bit more from that first lesson. Here's the teacher, John, trying to get Lucy to loosen up and speak like an American.
Take your hands, clasp them together, and go, yeah. Let it go.
That clip is ridiculous because clearly John is not a good English teacher. Tell me about his character.
In Japan, if you look like a foreigner, we call it gaijin, and they speak English, anyone could be an English teacher. They believe you that you can teach you the authentic English. You don't need any kind of credential. So that's kind of what John is. Josh and I talked about, like, the acting coaches in L.A. I definitely had one and used that as an inspiration of this character because of this, you know, how acting coaches make you do all these humiliating things to open yourself up as an actor. Mm. Or in this case, it's about learning English.
Well, I mean, he is an imposter, right? Because we eventually, the characters eventually go to California, to Los Angeles. When John suddenly leaves Tokyo, he goes to the United States. He takes Lucy's niece, Mika, with him, and the family goes searching for her. Talk about California, because in the film, it seems like Tokyo is this character in and of itself, a little drab, a little gray. And you get to California, and it's sunny and beautiful, and yet it is still has major problems.
Yeah, but actually it's not sunny and beautiful, if you notice in the film. It's actually gloomy, and I realized in the middle of the shooting, oh yeah, this is the movie is about, which is that wherever you go, you take your problem with you. Mm. You know, you have a romantic notion of California coming from Japan. Like, you know, palm trees, beautiful blue sky, and open land, and things would be so different when you go there. But actually, that location doesn't really change who you are in a way. Something you have in you would always stay the same, you know, like if you don't deal with it. So I realized that I used that weather and basically like, okay, I think this is what is the film is about.
Yeah, the film is very funny. There are moments when you laugh out loud listening to it, but then it will take a very dark turn unexpectedly. Variety called it a chocolate trifle with an arsenic core. Was that a compliment?
I would say so. I like it.
Why did you explore the film that way?
I did want to talk about these dark issues, but at the same time, I always appreciate something with humor, and life is that way. You can find humor in the most tragic situations, and which often happens in my life. So I always find like something very funny during the funeral. That's why I you shouldn't take me to funerals, like, because I'm gonna be laughing. Always, like, something weird happens during the funeral, for example. Everybody's crying, and I can't contain my laughter. So I don't know. Maybe that's part of who I am. I don't know.
No, I think it's part of
being
human.
I'm crazy, yeah.
okay, so you do cover some pretty hefty topics, though. Suicide is a major theme that runs from the very beginning to the very end of this film, and I don't want to give away any of the plot twists, but it seems like you wanted to say something about that.
That's the state of Setsuko's mind. So all the stuff happens around her because of who she is. So I think suicide becomes part of this story. It's because she is, in fact, a suicidal person. I mean, in a novel, you can write she's suicidal, and then you understand. But when you try to describe people by situations or actions, and then these incidences come to your story, I guess.
Hmm. You know what's interesting about the character of Lucy is that for much of the film, as we discussed, she's lead this quiet, sort of sad life, and you don't hear from her, really. I mean, you don't hear her voice, essentially, until she gets to California, and suddenly you hear her scream. She's with her sister. She fights with her sister, and suddenly you hear this woman's voice raging out of her. What's happening to Lucy?
Well, that was the whole point, right? Like this person who is hiding her true feelings, but then basically the Lucy gave her the character. But actually in Japan, there was a karaoke scene, remember? She has some kind of prelude to what happens.
Mm. She lashes out against a coworker who's retiring, and she says, you know, don't you realize these people are making fun of you all the time? They don't respect you. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's the other side of the office lady. Because she got to wear the mask of Lucy, she was allowed to speak out that side of her that's been panting up all these years. But at the end of the day, Lucy or Setsuko are neither her. That's my point.
That's writer-director Atsuko Hirayanagi. Her new film is Oh, Lucy. It's up for 2 Film Independent Spirit Awards. It begins to open in theaters today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Peter.
Some survivors of the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School have been speaking at rallies about gun violence. But 17-year-old student Amanda Edwards is channeling her grief a different way, by playing her piano. Youth Radio takes us to Edwards' home in Parkland, Florida, where she remembers her close friend and fellow music lover, Carmen Shentrup, who was killed in the Valentine's Day school shooting.
Well, I started playing when I was 3 years old. I didn't play for fun at all after what happened. I got scared a little bit of playing. I don't know why. So this is like the second time I've played since it happened. After the massacre, I've just kind of been laying low, I guess. I've also been avoiding public places a lot too, because I'm nervous and I'm a little bit shy. And I've always had the school shooter thing in the back of my mind. Ever since I was young, you know, I've always just had it. I don't know why. What if this happens? What if that happens? And one of my what ifs that I've always had in my entire mind just happened. So I guess this just confirmed my suspicions in a way. I went to the viewing for my friend, Carmen Shentrup, my close friend. I was not very good at making friends in the first place, and I first met her in freshman year when I was in orchestra. She sat in the back row. I just talked to her. She talked to me. Junior year, we had 5 classes together, so she was there for like a majority of my day in school. She's probably one of my closest friends ever, I guess. On Monday, before the school shooting happened, I saw her. She kind of slowed down a little bit because she saw me, and she said, you know, hi, and I said hi. I remember saying goodbye, and that was the last time, you know, I saw her, at least alive. And that hurt a lot after I found out and saw, you know, the body. I think we had a good time, though, as friends.
Amanda Edwards is a senior at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. Her story was produced by Youth Radio.
A ski resort in Big Sky, Montana, is considering a new technique to make snow for its slopes. They're thinking about using treated wastewater. Right now, the Yellowstone Club uses groundwater to make its snow, but that's also the source of the town's drinking water. And rapid growth in Big Sky is depleting those groundwater supplies, so there's a shortage there. But there's an abundance of wastewater. The treatment system is at near capacity, and one solution is to maybe dump the excess treated water into the nearby Gallatin River, but most people who live in the area do not want that to happen. So enter the idea of using treated wastewater to make snow, a sort of win-win for every water issue the town faces. Joining us now with more is Kristen Gardner. She's executive director of the Gallatin River Task Force in Big Sky, Montana. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, what I'm wondering is some people might kind of react with a ew, gross response to begin with, but we are talking about fully treated wastewater.
Correct. It's fully treated. And, you know, there is definitely that yuck factor, but you can potentially put the snow on areas where you might not have the younger children skiers.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, since you are a member of the Gallatin River Task Force, tell me, why is it better to put this treated wastewater into snow on the mountain than into the river?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, right now for snowmaking, they're using groundwater, and that is our only source of water, and there's no looking upstream for us. We are a headwaters community. And the second reason is if we do release the water higher up in the watershed, then that water has a chance to percolate into the groundwater and then feed the streams in times that we really need that water, which is in the late summertime.
Uh-huh. So I understand that you're, of course, not an expert in the science of snowmaking itself. But tell us, how much do you know about how this would work to make the snow?
Well, I think that it's, you know, probably a similar system that they use with the groundwater. It's just that the water needs to be pumped from where it is treated up to the mountain. So there will be substantial infrastructure that will need to be put in place to make this happen.
You got to get it up into altitude where you want to make the snow. Okay.
Correct.
So how has the idea been received in Big Sky?
You know, I think people are really positive about the benefits. The public has not wanted there to be a discharge into the Gallatin River. It's a highly valued stream for its fisheries and for its recreation. It supports abundant wildlife. And if water is placed into the ground, it has a chance for natural treatment. If it's put directly into the river, there's not as much of a chance that it could be even treated further.
Mm. Well, so I should note that this isn't the first time that treated wastewater has been used, or in your case, it's being proposed for Big Sky, but it's not the first time it's actually been done, right? There's a ski resort in Flagstaff, Arizona, that's been apparently doing this for years. So it's
correct.
The proof of concept is there. It works. And if and when this happens, would you ski on those slopes?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Kristen Gardner is executive director of the Gallatin River Task Force in Big Sky, Montana. Thank you, Kristen, so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
More than 20 states allow community colleges to offer bachelor degrees. Schools are responding to forecasts that show a disconnect between the types of jobs that'll be available in the U.S. and the number of educated workers available to fill them. Ohio, for example, needs to up the number of workers with post-secondary degrees by 20% in just 2 years to keep up with demand. Ashton Mara from State Impact Ohio reports.
Getting to fly the drone, it's like playing a video game.
Carter McKevich is a 20-year-old Dayton native who's in his second semester at St. Clair Community College in his hometown. McKevich spent a year working on a theater degree at the University of Toledo before transferring to the UAS program at St. Clair. UAS stands for Unmanned Aerial Systems, drone technology.
It is very exciting to know that within the next few years I could be in a field that a lot of people are going to want to be in, but I'll already be there.
McKevich is working on an associate degree, but that could soon change thanks to a provision in Ohio's most recent budget bill.
It started legislatively probably about 4 years ago, a couple budgets ago.
Stephanie Davidson is overseeing the process for the State Department of Higher Education that would allow some Ohio community colleges to offer applied bachelor's degrees on their campuses, degrees that prepare students to work in highly technical career fields.
It's really a two-step process. The first step is for institutions to tell the chancellor what their plans are, what programs they're considering.
So far, six schools have applied to offer 9 degrees, including St. Clair Community College. There, faculty like Dr. Andrew Shepard have been working to create a bachelor's in drone technology, which will build off of their already existing associate degree.
So the students will go off and not just knowing how to fly the aircraft, but then applying the aircraft more specifically in real-world scenarios.
Those real-world scenarios could include hands-on experience inspecting bridges, conducting ecological health surveys, or piloting emergency rescue operations during a natural disaster, like a flood. Sinclair's UAS proposal seems to meet all of the requirements of the Ohio law governing it. It isn't offered by any other four-year institution in the state. It's financially viable for the college to not just create, but operate into the future. There's a demonstrated workforce need. 100,000 jobs are expected to be created in the field over the next 10 years, and it has the support of local businesses like Unmanned Solutions Technology. Kent Tiffany is the Dayton company's founder and CEO.
I'm always in search of good people.
Tiffany's company conducts drone missions, but designs and builds the technology too. He says at any given moment, a new contract could double, triple, even quadruple his staff of 6 overnight, and he needs highly educated people to be ready to come on board.
Will a 2-year student work? The answer is yes. Would a 4-year student give me more capability? Very much so. If there's more of that background knowledge, that helps us go pursue that work.
But not everyone in Ohio is as excited about the expansion of the bachelor's degree offerings. Dr. Martin Abraham is the provost of Youngstown State University.
I mean, it sounds good. Tuition is lower. It's going to save students money. The challenge is that there's a reason that tuition is lower.
Four-year other institutions challenge students with a higher level of thinking and broaden their base of knowledge. But more than that, Abraham says a number of the degrees being considered are already offered. It's repetitive, he says, repetitive in a state where the resources to support higher education are hard to come by.
So we're creating this internal competition that's probably not healthy for the state and certainly not healthy for the state budget.
Despite the criticism, the Ohio Department of Higher Education has recently wrapped up the public comment portion of its review process. Stephanie Davidson says next comes department approval and outside accreditation. Sinclair Community College could begin offering its bachelor's degree in drone technology in the fall of 2019. Sinclair student Carter McKevich will have completed his associate degree by then, but says he'd come back for the four-year program.
That technology is new and cutting edge, so if I can get my foot in with his two-year degree and then come back for the four-year degree, then why not?
McKevich wants to work in agriculture, tracking soil levels or monitoring crops, but knows in an up-and-coming industry, he has plenty of options. For Here and Now, I'm Ashton Mara.
Well, the Academy Awards are Sunday night, and among the nominees for Best Documentary Short is Heaven is a Traffic Jam on the 405. It's director Frank Stifel's third film. Each one is about strong women, and Mindy Alper is the focus of this one. It's a story about a person who stares down personal challenges through art. Karen Michelle has more.
Heaven is a Traffic Jam on the 405 opens with a scene of Mindy Alper happily stuck in Los Angeles traffic.
I love being inside of the 405 freeway in my car during traffic. Long as I'm not late or have to pee, it's heaven.
As someone who came of driving age in L.A., I can attest the 405 is reviled. But when director Frank Stifel heard Mindy Alper profess her fondness for it,
I thought if ever there was a line that described somebody who looks at the world differently than many of us, that's the line. So I knew it was the title.
I didn't understand why did he want to film me. I'm pretty sure he didn't know either, but I thought it could be fun.
Mindy Alper is a bundle of anxieties. She's suffered since childhood, being on a changing mix of meds, growing up with a mother who wouldn't touch her, and a father who, while denying that his daughter had mental health issues, touched too much. She was hospitalized and spent a decade not speaking, so she expressed herself through art.
I was extremely prolific, as you can imagine, because I had to express everything that way. And I think I did some of my most interesting drawings during that time because I really had to. But the way I think is in pixels anyway.
The line drawings, most of them in black and white, are representational in a way that's not literal, but expresses her frustrations and anger. Figures yell and stomp and are as animated and noisy as a flat, silent page can be. And it's through this work that Mindy Alper came to the attention of prominent Los Angeles gallerist Rosamund Felsen, who was wowed.
I thought the work was so incredible. It needed to be seen. And I've never worked with an artist with these kinds of neurological conditions. And it was such a natural. I had this theory that I've had for years that there are some artists who are literally born with a pencil in their hand. And she was one of the few.
As a child, Mindy Alper took lessons from a woman who became a second, more affectionate mother and started exhibiting her work. After she came out of her 10 years of silence and shock treatments, Tom Woodall became her teacher.
So this is a day that we've all been waiting for, right?
And maybe you could tell us a little bit about the challenges.
Okay. I had to give up all my ideas I had in my head.
A scene in the film shows a class critique of one of Alper's way larger-than-life-sized papier-mâché sculptures. Though she's very self-critical, the students in Woodall are supportive. He still is.
The first thing I wanted to do is to reassure her that whatever her condition was, it was not going to affect her creativity in any way whatsoever. If she had an opportunity to work freely without the burden of her condition, she would be a formidable force. I mean, she would be, I think, an artist that would have a what is known as a career and would have a much more public life in art. She's an unbelievably gifted person. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
Though sometimes she's defined by her illness more than her art.
I'm just a person who struggles through life. And right now, I don't know how to do anything else. So I guess that makes me an artist by default.
In the film, we see the preparations and opening of a show of Alper's work at Rosamund Felsen's gallery.
As it turns out, a lot of people came.
There's a nervous Mindy loading in the work. Sometimes she frets that it's all terrible, other times admitting that maybe it's not. The opening is packed, festive, but Alper has trouble with groups of people she doesn't know, adding to her anxiety.
It was really nice to get that much love and attention from people. It was really, really nice. I tried to enjoy it because it may never happen again.
Her dealer is hoping for another show, and there are the Academy Awards.
I am afraid to go to the Oscars.
But she's rented a tux and already knows who she'd like to play her in a feature film based on her life.
I would hope Danny DeVito would play me. And if he wasn't available, of course, Daniel Day-Lewis.
For NPR News, I'm Karen Michelle.
Daniel Day-Lewis can be anyone. He's so good.
Every year, about 2.6 million babies around the world die within a month of their birth. That's according to a recent UNICEF report. A million of those babies are born and die on the same day. Now, the risks to newborns vary widely depending on what country the baby is born in. Take, for example, Pakistan. It has the highest rate of infant mortality in the world. 46 out of every 1,000 babies born there die within their first month. Contrast that with Japan, where it's just one of every 1,000 babies. The majority of these deaths are preventable. And in Bangladesh, there's been a concerted effort to reduce the newborn mortality rate. And it's working. NPR's global health and development correspondent Nurit Eisenman is here with us. She joins us now. Hi there.
Hi.
So first of all, where does Bangladesh currently rank when it comes to newborn mortality?
Well, it still has a very high rate and a very high number of newborn deaths. But what's really remarkable is how much progress it's made in the last 20 years. So back in 1990, there were 64 newborns dying per 1,000 births. And today, it's about 20 newborns dying per 1,000 births.
Wow, so a very dramatic drop then. Okay, so before we get to exactly what Bangladesh is doing that seems to be working, can you just briefly go over sort of what are the common causes of newborn mortality?
Yeah, so back in 1990s, and even in the 2000s, when Bangladesh was really trying to turn its attention to this problem, a lot of the deaths, the majority of the deaths, were due to asphyxia, basically inability to breathe, and that was the result of prolonged obstructed labor. And the reason, often, was that about 90% of the births were taking place in people's homes, attended just by relatives of the mother, you know, people who weren't particularly trained to do this. And as a result, you'd have these very difficult deliveries, and the infant, you know, would be asphyxiated in the process.
I see. So then what are some of the things that Bangladesh has been doing to address those issues?
A big part of the push was to try to shift the share of births that take place in homes and move them into facilities where there were healthcare workers who could assist. So part of that was just, you know, building health facilities. A large reason why you had so many deliveries in homes was because there wasn't any place else to go, particularly in rural areas. But there was also this big effort on messaging. I've talked to some of the experts who were involved, and they said even in areas where there might be a facility nearby, you know, it's a conservative Muslim country, it's a conservative culture, and there was sort of this stigma that, you know, a woman's not supposed to show her body to a male doctor. So that was some of the messaging that they had to get across. And just to really convey to people the benefits of going to health facilities and to remove this stigma.
Okay. And so what about the additional challenges that come along with the fact that Bangladesh is a highly populous, you know, densely populated country, still developing country? I mean, did they have the health care and maternal care infrastructure available in order to move these women away from home births into other facilities?
I mean, that was a big part of the push, was really trying to build up that infrastructure, and it's a work in progress. So one of the issues that I'm told is that, okay, now they have more facilities, yes, but the facilities aren't 24/7. Deliveries can happen at any point. You know, it's not on a schedule. And so that's one of the new pushes. And then also training of the health workers still, even in the facilities, to be better at easing deliveries that are difficult. And then another issue is trying to bring in women for prenatal checkups, because you need to predict, mm-hmm. you know, if it's going to be a difficult labor, if it's an at-risk pregnancy. So there's still work to be done.
Yeah. You know, Nurit, a minute ago, you were saying interesting things about how, you know, it's not just sort of medical infrastructure, but larger messaging, public health messaging, and social change also, that it seems as if Bangladesh is trying to move towards in order to reduce its newborn mortality rate. And I wonder, to that point, I mean, are there some more sort of socially stubborn challenges than others? And I mean, I'll just be direct about it, because this is a country that has it's not uncommon for young girls to get married.
Yes, you've put your finger on it. Child marriage is now one of the big issues. So asphyxia has gone down as a cause. But premature births has now become the largest factor. And premature births is very much linked to young mothers, teenagers and younger. When they give birth to a child, they're just much more likely to give birth prematurely. And so now part of the effort is very much around educating people about the health risks of young motherhood, and trying to, you know, use that as an argument against child marriage.
Mm. Now, have other countries been looking at Bangladesh's success so far and seeking to emulate it? I mean, just nearby in Pakistan, we were saying how Pakistan has the highest infant mortality rate in the world.
Yeah, I mean, in Pakistan, it's like one out of every 22 newborns are dying. I mean, it's incredibly high. And I think, you know, part of this larger report that UNICEF has come out with has really showed that this is still a major problem across the world, particularly in poor countries, although frankly, the U.S. isn't doing that well compared to comparable wealthy countries. Part of why Bangladesh stands out, frankly, is because it has made a lot of progress. Overall, there hasn't been a lot of progress on this issue over the last 20 years globally.
Well, Nurit Eisenman is NPR's Global Health and Development Correspondent. Nurit, thanks so much.
Glad to do it.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.